St David's. Perched on a hill above the Exe, it's been a community for almost 1,000 years. It's played an integral role in Exeter's history since medieval times. It's seen the rise and fall of the woolen trade and the railway revolution of the 19th century. It's played a part in 2 world wars and has become an educational hub. Over these next 3 programmes, we'll chart the story of St David's as it strides into the future. From its past medieval industries, through its present to its very modern future aspirations and hopes. And it'll be a people's story, told by its residents and friends. Our journey starts in the medieval period, when Exeter was fast expanding as a centre of trade and commerce. In the Middle Ages, St David's was well established as a settlement and formed one of the major thoroughfares into the city. The 1377 poll tax gives us one of the first accurate estimations of Exeter's population, at just over 2,500 people. Remarkably, this means that Exeter was one of the largest cities in the country. The key to Exeter's success was its trade and industry, namely the woolen trade. I met Peter and Patricia Faulkner, who live in one of St David's oldest surviving properties, to hear about the post-medieval history of St David's and its role in the cloth industry.
In front of the fireplace there, they discovered there was a big vat there where they would have dyed the wool as part of the woolen trade, because, you know, obviously it's on the road from Tiverton to Exeter, and so it's all part of the woolen business, and this was the dyeing area.
But, well, one of the dyeing areas.
Yeah, one of the places where that took place.
So by at least 1600, St David's had become an integral cog in the workings of Exeter's industry. The woolen trade in Exeter has probably existed since Roman times, and for much of the country's history, it's formed the backbone of the economy. In Exeter, much of the city's present form is a result of this industry. The quay and canal, the merchants' houses which make up much of the centre, the old bridge at the bottom of the hill, the Guildhall and Tucker's Hall. They're all signs of a medieval centre of commerce which revolved around cloth. The famous traveller Celia Fiennes remarked when she visited the city in 1698 that the whole town and country is employed for at least 20 miles round in spinning, weaving, dressing and scouring. It turns the most money in a week of anything in England. One week with another there is £10,000. The industry in St David's then was part of a great process of production, which put Exeter on the map, as it were, and established its importance as a centre of trade and commerce. But it wasn't to last. By the early 19th century, the wool trade was in decline. New mechanised equipment drove prices down, cheaper foreign exports increased competition, and the widespread introduction of cotton caused the wool market to collapse. This centuries-old industry, which had created Exeter as a preeminent commercial centre, was dying. But Exeter was still expanding and developing. One of the most characteristic features of St David's, the Iron Bridge, was built during this period, in 1834.
There was apparently...
I joined the Faulkners as they looked through documents relating to
in
its construction.
The bridge, you see, they had to take some people's land. This is quite interesting. The masonry was to be provided by Whittaker, and the total cost of the bridge was estimated at £8,972, 3 shillings and 3 pence. Not including consequential damages. Here we are, this is quite interesting. 1810, the Exeter Improvement Act came into force on the 2nd of June. Section 51 gave the commissioners power to acquire by purchase properties encroaching on any footway, highway, or any land purchase for improving and widening streets, lanes, public passages, or places. There was compulsory purchase.
Wow.
Which one doesn't think of in sort of early 1800s.
No, but as you can see, it was necessary because, you know, they wanted to get these vehicles coming in from Tiverton. Lower North Street was such a hopeless thing. And there used to be a pub at the far end. What was it called?
Oh, the Pack Horse.
Yeah, the Pack Horse. There was a pub called the Pack Horse, you see. So they obviously used to use pack horses to bring them down and get them up into the city. And then in the 1830s, they decided that they could be more efficient. And so they put this wonderful bridge.
I think they had traffic problems. I mean, they had too many pack horses coming down the hill.
Put up the bridge and flattened it out and left this as a slightly odd area at the side here.
Like most cities in the 19th century, the rapid expansion of trade and populations caused logistical issues. The city could no longer cope with the amount of traffic. A new solution was needed if Exeter was to continue to prosper.
Platform 4 for the 13.
By the 1840s, a new industry was in town. The railway revolution of the 19th century had arrived in Exeter. The first station was built at the bottom of St David's in 1844 by the famous inventor Isambard Kingdom Brunel. Once again, St David's took on an industrial importance as a centre for transport and industry. Now a mass of products could be distributed all across the country, speedily and efficiently. If it was the wool industry which was responsible for much of Exeter's pre-industrial development, it was the arrival of the railways which formed much of its modern form. The many stations, the warehouses and factories, the new estates and terraces, they were all a result of the railways and the increased economic activity they brought with them. New industries sprung up alongside the tracks. There were coal merchants, sawmills, food depots. Everything now went via rail. The railway boom lasted well into the 20th century. Leonard Lawrence, who has lived in St David's all his life, can remember the railways when they were still an integral part of Exeter and St David's.
Up there, that used to be what we called it, the coal yard.
Right.
Because that's near enough where most of the coal merchants in Exeter were based, right up to Central Station. There was a timber place up there.
Right by the railway, I guess, so quite convenient.
This is it. Coal trucks could be shunted back in all the sidings down there.
Yeah.
And every coal yard had their own little piece. And they'd shovel the coal straight out the truck, weigh it, bag it on their little carts and lorries, and off they'd go delivering it.
Mm.
But that's why it was called the coal yard, because there was coal depots all over the place. Of course, then they distribute out to all the different parts of the city and beyond.
Yeah.
Everybody had their own round. I can't think of anywhere else where there was such a concentration of coal people as what there was up there. But yeah, there was sidings everywhere, good sidings, all behind Low and Ore Street. Was all railway sidings where they used to keep the coaches or wagons or whatever they had to shunt back.
So the railway was really at the heart of St David's, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. Well, it employed a lot of people. You just imagine back in those days, everything was steam. So you had two men in the fire engine.
Mm.
Then you had a guard. So that's three people on every train. Then you had shunters and wheel tappers and all the people that cleaned the carriages. Down the other side of Queen Street, all that yard down through there was all side ends and big warehouses, because everything came by rail.
Yeah.
So the goods wagons would back up alongside the warehouses, the doors would open, and all the blokes would unload crossing Blackwell tin soup and all that stuff and store it in the warehouse. Then it would get delivered by the little lorries that they had. Have you ever seen any of the old lorries that they had years ago?
No, I haven't, no.
Little three-wheelers, just like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the cab. Yeah. The cab in the front was a little three-wheeler. And it would turn around out there.
Wow.
Without any trouble.
Yeah.
Because the wheel in the front sort of went right around.
Yeah, yeah. That's clever, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a little Artec.
Mm.
And, they didn't need to reverse around anywhere. They just turned around and went down the road again. But that's how it was. Everything came by rail. But like you say, the infrastructure around here was all geared up around the railways, really.
Mm.
It was the heart of the community because it employed so many people.
In St David's, another important centre for the community were its churches. A chapel has existed here since at least the 12th century. Jeff Crockett, the tower captain at St David's, explained the parish's history to Laura Denning.
F sharp and G. And the tenor and the treble, they were added in 1887 for the Diamond Jubilee of Victoria and added to the bells that were here, in the previous church, 1817. So 1817 were the bells from the previous church. Two were added at the end of the life of the previous church. That church was knocked down and this one built in its place. And all the bells came back together. Yeah.
And the Whitechapel Bell Foundry is very, very famous as a bellmaker, isn't it?
Yes, very famous as a
bellmaker. Why was the first church dismantled?
Well, it wasn't the first, that was the third, but it was dismantled because it was felt to be old-fashioned compared, because St Michael's had been built on Mount Dinham, and it was sort of, at that time, you know, all modern and nice and new, and this was the main church, and it was beginning to look dowdy against it. So they decided they wanted a new church.
Gosh.
And that's what it got. So it's been, it was built within the foundations of the other one.
And do you know how long the church has stood on this site?
This site since 1817. Before that, it was closer to the main road near the shop, Packhorse. So there was a chapel there in 1541, something like that. And then there was a previous one then, before that. Not sure whether that's on the same site or nearer the river.
So St David's Church is gradually moving up the hill.
Yes, away from the river, yeah. Has indeed.
As well as a new church in St David's, the 20th century also heralded the creation of an electric tram system throughout parts of Exeter. Horse-drawn trams had operated in the city since an Act of Parliament in 1881, but had faced financial difficulties. In September 1885, St David's was the scene of a tram accident when the brakes failed as it went down the hill. In 1904, an all-electric tram system replaced it, and the service quickly expanded to include the High Street. At its height, there were trams every 8 minutes, with 80,000 passengers travelling each week in 1905. Now mass transport had been localised in a way the trains had never managed. Inner-city public transport was born. The prosperity which had marked the first decade of the 20th century soon gave way to austerity. On the 4th of August 1914, Britain declared a war on Germany. The First World War had a large impact on the trams, as 60% of its labour force was conscripted overseas. Women were employed for the first time, but were not permitted to operate the engines. Due to these constraints, many services did not run full length, and fewer trams ran per minute. The war also had an effect on maintenance, as fewer materials were available and fewer funds were allocated. The only fatal accident happened during the war, when a tram collided with a lorry. Exeter lost near on 1,000 people in World War I, some of whom were from St David's. During the interwar periods, the trams resumed and continued to provide mass transport around the city. However, by the late 1920s, traffic was once again a major problem in Exeter, as the amount of motor cars increased. In 1930, the decision was finally made to replace the trams with buses. A new age of public transport had begun. The interwar years saw the rapid expansion of Exeter's cultural scene. A number of theatres and cinemas opened throughout the city, including the Odeon and the Savoy. The Gaumont opened in 1932 on North Street, just along from St David's. The proliferation of the motor car continued, and Exeter saw increased tourist traffic, as a new era of adventure and travel began. But it wasn't all rosy. The interwar years brought with them mass unemployment and poverty, as markets slumped and the economy crashed. The 20th century had already proven a time of great change, but even greater changes were on their way, as Europe and the world was once again torn apart by conflict.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
The Second World War would see Exeter lose over 2,000 people, both soldiers and civilians, some from St David's. 1:30 a.m. on the 4th of May 1942, the largest raid to hit Exeter during the war began. 75 tons of high explosives were dropped, plus 10,000 incendiary bombs, in a raid which lasted an hour and a half. The cold light of day revealed the damage. 400 buildings had been totally destroyed, including much of the centre. 161 civilians had been killed. St David's was luckier than many places. Leonard Lawrence was a small child in St David's during the war.
I saw my brother last night. He's older than me. Now, down Low and Ore Street, on the right-hand side, are some, I don't know what you call them, they're units. They sat back under the bridge.
Okay.
The bridge was like built over the top of them. Mm. And we used to use those, one of those, as an air raid shelter.
Right.
I mean, yeah. I can't remember, but I wasn't very old. But my brother said, they were all down there one day, and they all come back up the hill, and Mum had left a baby's bottle behind. So Brother Fred ran down to get it. He said, as I was down there getting it, a German plane come over and dropped some incendiary bombs. And if you notice on the end of Dinham Road, mm-hmm. there's about four houses missing.
Yeah, wildly.
And that's where the incendiary bomb dropped. He said he was lucky as hell because he was coming back up the hill. The blast blew the chimney off of the house this side of Dinham Road. He said all the brickwork went right over. He said if I'd have been a second later, the brickwork would have gone down over and caught him.
Leonard remembers another close encounter with the war a few years later.
I couldn't have been no more than two or three. But I was sat on a step and an army lorry come down the road, American truck, skidded on the ice, went through the railings, and because the railings are thick cast iron, I don't know if you know anything about cast iron.
Not a huge amount, no.
It doesn't bend.
Right, okay.
So if you was to hit it with a sledgehammer, it shatters.
Right, okay.
So the cast iron pieces shattered off, and all the front of the house was peppered in holes with bits of iron stuck in, and one of them went over my head, through the door, up the passageway, and stuck in the stairs.
Wow, that's pretty lucky, isn't it?
And Mum said, if I'd have been stood up,
it
would have gone
right
through me. But because I was sat down, she said it went right over your head.
When was that?
Well, that would have been probably about 45, 44, 45.
After the war, much of Exeter was rebuilt, but you can still see gaps in many streets where houses used to stand. As Leonard noted, the patch of ground opposite the Iron Bridge is one of these, and is a silent but pertinent reminder of the impact of the Second World War, even in the far western fringe of England. As Exeter recovered, the area around St David's became a centre for education in the city, an observation still evident today. A number of schools had sprung up here throughout the centuries, the Maynard School and Heald School, for instance. Exeter College is now based in St David's, and Exeter University's Streatham campus is just up the hill. On North Street itself, the West of England Institution for the Instruction and Employment of the Blind opened in what is now Exeter Community Centre. The school moved there in 1842 after outgrowing its previous facilities. It remained there until 1965, becoming the West of England School for the Partially Sighted in 1944. I met some former pupils and staff at a reunion at their old school, one of whom told me about her memories of the war.
They brought us up here when I was here, because I was in the war, and made us into where we had our food and all that, and they bought the stuff up, because they took us down there so they could get us out. So.
Yeah. So you were here during...
During the war. Oh, yes. I came in 38, and the war broke out in 39. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I remember Exeter being bombed.
Yeah,
we was up the shelter.
Shelter in the garden?
Up that backyard there, where the workshops used to be.
Oh, right, okay.
Up there used to be like a brick shelter where we went.
Were raids quite regular?
Did you have to go in there quite often?
Was it a few times we did, remember the siren went, you know, but we definitely went in the night the Blitz was, because the next day they had to shift us all. They had the school did, was lucky, they didn't get no bombs.
This was the first time many had returned to their school. I recorded them as they rediscovered it.
This used to be our main dining room for the boys and girls, wasn't it? Yeah. We came back from holidays and they had lovely round tables with individual chairs or something. And then the boys' day room backed on the other side.
Okay.
Yeah. Naturally, this was all just sealed. There was no doors or nothing.
Yeah.
And it was an open window to next door.
That would have been the entrance to the kitchen.
That's right, the kitchen where Connor did all their work.
So this is the main dining room.
And then you would have been served here.
Girls on that side, boys on the hot plate, because it's a lot wider. Used to go right over to the outer wall.
And then that was the door through to the boys' junior day room.
That's right. Yeah. And there were stairs up there, weren't there?
Yeah. Then they've been taken out.
Have they?
Yeah.
So this was a bit bigger.
It used to go right across to the back wall because the windows both sides.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So they've narrowed the room down a bit.
I mean, the storerooms of the kitchen and the senior boys' day room, they've knocked it into one. That's where we were just now.
Yeah. How many people came here?
80 plus day, I think.
And there's people from, you know, naturally Devon and Cornwall, and then up as far as Gloucester, Surrey.
Right. Oh, there were people here from London, from Scotland, from Yorkshire, from Lancashire.
See, look, 5 years old, I was sent packing, you know, crying my eyes out on a coach to come down to Exeter. And, you know, that was it.
Did you have a good time then, once you got here?
Yeah. I mean, when you're 5 years old, you know, you think your world's falling apart, taken away from your mum, dad and brother. But like I say, once you got here, you kind of fitted in and forgot about them till holiday time. When I was about 6 or 7 years old, I can remember one Sunday, my mum and dad borrowed a car from the licensee of a pub that he used to use in Southampton. And he said, "You can borrow this car." He said, "What do I need it for?" He said, "I want to go down and see my boy down at Exeter School." So he said, "No problem, full of petrol." They came down. They picked me up from the school here. They took me up to the bus station in, is it Paul Street?
Yeah.
On the left.
Yeah.
Sat there and had a dish of peaches and cream.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, honestly. And then they brought me back here, gave me pocket money, and then they drove home.
Yeah.
And that took them from like 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And they got back home about 8 o'clock at night.
Gosh.
Yeah. And that was just for one Sunday. Yeah. No.
Were the boarding houses here as well? Or
oh, yes. Yeah. That was the girls' side up here. On that we came in on.
Okay.
That was the girls' side, and down on this side was all the boys' side.
Oh.
Up there was a gay girls' day room where they used to have their evening entertainment play, and you know, they got to be in bed by 7 o'clock.
Wow.
It'd be a jurisdiction. The older they got, the later they got. 9 o'clock, I think, is the oldest there was.
Diane, was that my dining room there?
No, this was your dining room. Here, your lounge.
No,
your lounge.
The sitting room, I mean.
Yeah, that was the sitting room. And that was Sean's bedroom.
And when I came back on the staff, my bedroom was somewhere around here.
You were up. That one.
Whoops.
Yeah. I was out the front.
And the surgery was up
there. No, you had two windows, that one
and
that one.
And I think that would have been Tim's bedroom, which was
fire. That's right.
And the surgery, that was the surgery.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Up there, and the ones around the front. Yes. The whole of that there was all the sick bay and surgery.
And then that was when we were older in that dormitory, the high set of windows, and we had a girl called Ivy Park. She was a right daredevil. And she pushed up the window, the second window along, and sat on the edge of the window.
Who was it?
She was called Ivy Park. She was in trouble. When Miss Osborne came in and caught her, what are you doing?
Oh, my goodness.
Why did she didn't fall out the window or something?
Yeah.
So what sort of things did you learn here?
Oh, learned sort of maths, English, geography, history.
All the usual stuff.
All the usual stuff.
Okay.
Art, did a bit of handicraft. Oh, right. Handicraft, like sort of weaving and sort of leathercraft, things like that. Cane work.
Okay.
I mean, I could not master cane work. That was sort of more for the boys. It's sort of making baskets and plant pots that out of willow.
One of the staff, Diane Dunn, told me about what it was like for families at the school.
I came here to work when I was 15, and I was actually younger than the children who were here at school, and I was didn't work with the children then. I started life in the kitchen and serving meals and working in the staff dining room, looking after the staff. And then when I became 16, I then started looking after the children and putting them to bed and became a house mother. And I was also a house mother out at Countess Weir.
What did that involve?
That involved getting children up in the morning, getting them, making sure they were dressed, got down to breakfast, and then getting them ready to go to school. Just like being at home, as mum would get you ready for school and make sure you had everything. Then we would probably have a few hours off during the day and then have to be back in the evenings to bath and put children to bed. That was really good, and we had lots of fun. I worked with the junior, the smallest of children. They could come to school from the age of five. Beginning of school term could be very heartbreaking when you could see children coming into school at the age of five and being left, and mum and dad going away and leaving them. Back in those days, children weren't explained to them why and what was going to happen to them, and suddenly they're left in this big building with lots of other children, and you did your best to make them feel at home and play with them and things. Children, I think, got over it maybe a bit sooner than mums and dads, who must have been a terrible wrench.
What do you think were the decisions going through parents' minds then that thought, this is where I want my children to be?
Well, my brother was sent to this school, and many years later my mother told me that it was the most heartbreaking decision that she had to make, to send my brother here to school. But with hindsight, as far as he was concerned, it was the best decision. He had a wonderful education here, and he went on to a really good job, and a job that he holds down today. And I think a lot of that was down to the education that he had here at this school. He found that a lot of the time there was things going on at weekends. They were going away doing camping and things, and he wanted to be part of it. So therefore he was staying at school a lot more during the weekends. The downside of that, as probably many of them will say, that when they went home for holidays, they were almost out on a limb because all their friends were here.
The school moved to a new site in Countess Weir in 1965.
We had a bit of a wine and cheese party on the last night, so we'd all had plenty to drink. And I said, I am going up and I am going to ride down the banister. And I went to the top of the building and I came swinging round and landed on the big round bit at the bottom. I enjoyed that. I'm going back to do it again. And that was one of my recollections of leaving here.
That sounds good fun.
The last few decades in Exeter has been characterised by the centralisation of services. In St David's, many of the things which had previously held the community together, the reliance on the railway, the corner shops and inns, have mostly been converted into housing. Walking down North Street, one sees many a closed shop and pub. The Pack Horse, which the Faulkners talked of, is now housing, as are the sweet shops which Leonard remembered.
What's the heart of the community now, do you think? Is there one?
I don't think there is, actually. I don't think there is.
Over the last couple of decades, the whole idea of what a community is seems to have changed. The challenge for the future will be redefining what a modern urban community is and moving forwards towards that. In 2010, after a long campaign to secure the building for community use, Exeter Community Centre opened up in the old school in order to try and breathe life back into St David's and provide a focus for community events and participation. Over the rest of the series, we'll be looking at the present of St David's and where people want to see it going in the future.